February 2013, a young couple murdered in Irvine, California. Young lovers engaged to be married, gunned down.
They were slumped in a car atop a parking structure where they lived in Irvine.
Why were they targeted? One day later, the manifesto revealed.
This manifesto goes on for 20 long pages. Here it is when you read this thing.
The name, Christopher Dorner, a disgruntled former LAPD officer.
That all of this, his anger, may stem from the fact that he was terminated in January of 09.
On a mission for revenge. His first victims, that daughter of an LAPD captain and her fiance.
This morning we've seen an apparent fatal revenge plot play out before our eyes.
For the next week, a manhunt the likes of which Southern California had never seen.
We have strong cause to believe Dorner is armed and dangerous.
From LA to San Diego, Orange County to the Inland Empire.
Dorner's whereabouts are currently unknown to law enforcement.
Some of the crews today were stretching out some 6 miles trying to see any type of sign for Christopher Dorner.
Officers targeted, their families threatened.
Many of those threatened in Dorner's manifesto are members of the LAPD, where he was an officer.
Innocent civilians caught in the middle.
Their bodies, you may recall, were found in Lawrence's car Sunday night.
A region under siege.
He was out, he was loose. He'd already proven that he would kill, and he said he was going to kill again.
In the end, 4 people would die. Others would be injured.
This is a vendetta against all of Southern California law enforcement.
Christopher Dorner has said that he will not be taken into custody alive.
Chris Dorner died during a standoff in his mountain hideaway.
A brief exchange of gunfire occurred.
This has gone far enough. Nobody else needs to die.
From the manifesto to the manhunt to the hideout and shootout in the mountains.
Looks like the house is on fire there,
yes.
Kevin.
Yeah, the house was lit on fire.
We believe that Chris Dorner, the fugitive that's been on the run for about a week, who's gone on a murderous rampage, has met his fate inside this cabin.
The case, the lessons learned. New interviews never before heard until now. From the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, this is Chris Dorner. Badge of Dishonor. Part 1. The Manifesto.
We've assembled quite a group of people here in this room. I'm Hal Eisner. I'm a reporter and a host here at Fox 11 in Los Angeles, covering news for 37 years. And Dorner, the case against Christopher Dorner, one of the strangest and longest-running stories I remember in a very long time. And that's what we're going to talk about. Pete?
I'm Pete Wilgorn, managing editor here at Fox LA. I've been in the news business 20-plus years. I've been in Los Angeles 15 years now. And the name Chris Dorner is one that I'll never forget. Those 10 days are unlike anything I've ever seen before.
I'm Laura Diaz, a longtime anchor and reporter here in Los Angeles, decades long. And I think that I have a special commitment that I do covering issues having to do with crime and law enforcement. And what I remember the most about the Christopher Dorner 10-day episode, crisis, if you will, was just merely how long it was and how terrified not only the city was, but law enforcement, who were entrusted to keep us safe, they were the target and also the investigators. And I think that's what makes this case so very compelling.
Dr. Lieberman?
Hi, I'm Dr. Kara Lieberman. I'm a forensic psychiatrist and legal analyst. I remember the Christopher Dorner case. I think what I remember most, the image that sticks in my mind most, is his being in the cabin in Big Bear and being surrounded by police and, you know, it was sort of a countdown situation.
I'm Phil Schumann. I've been a reporter and an anchor in L.A. since the early 80s. And so many huge stories have happened in Southern California that it's easy to sort of forget the significance of Dorner when you look at other things like O.J. and Rodney King and others. But there was nothing like this time in my memory when, as Laura mentioned, everybody was terrified, never knowing what was going to happen next.
Terrified. And I don't think we had ever seen a situation where somebody with a badge had gone out and killed other people with badges or family members of people with badges.
And his training and his training. Remember, he was also in the Navy. He was a Navy reserve officer. So that was made it more challenging because of his knowledge of law enforcement tactics and investigative techniques helped him commit his crimes and also evade capture.
Not only in executing the crimes, but understanding how he had to duck and dodge, how he had to run from the people that would be after him, and understanding right. how they would deal with that. Laura, you talked to Chief Beck, police chief in Los Angeles, during the time all this was going on. What did he sort of start off his thinking with on this?
Well, initially, they did not know that it was connected to the LAPD. As you recall, when Monica Kwan and her fiancé were shot in Irvine, they thought that it was random violence, that it was just a terrible coincidence that this was the daughter of Randy Kwan, who was a former captain at the LAPD, the highest-ranking Asian-American in the department at the time. So,
who represented him in the hearing. Board of Rights hearing?
Right. He represented... Right. Dorner in the Board of Rights hearing, and Dorner felt that Randy Kwan had failed him. And when we get to the manifesto, he singles him out as somebody who he thought had worked against him in his effort to clear his name. So he blamed a number of people, and he sought to seek revenge against those people.
And maybe that's the interesting thing, Pete, about this, the notion of revenge, cop against cops.
Let's focus it a little bit. So the podcast is called Chris Dorner, Badge of Dishonor. And I think for many folks, the story starts not with who he was or what the crimes were or the Board of Rights hearing. For many folks, myself included, it starts with that manifesto. We knew of some crimes in Los Angeles, but when this came out, when this document surfaced one weekday night in all of our newsrooms, that's when we knew that this was a different type of case than we had dealt with here in Los Angeles.
Excerpts from the manifesto.
This manifesto goes on for 20 long pages. Here it is. When you read this thing, it is haunting. It is scary at times. It just rambles on other times.
Many of those threatened in Dorner's manifesto are members of the LAPD, where he was an officer.
That all of this, his anger, may stem from the fact that he was terminated in January of 2009.
Well, let's start at the very beginning of it, because it's like a memo from Christopher Jordan Dorner, 7648, I'm gathering that's the badge number, right? And it says, to America, regarding last resort. That's the subject. I know most of you who personally know me are in disbelief to hear from media reports that I am suspected of committing such horrendous murders and have taken drastic and shocking actions in the last couple of days. You're saying to yourself that this is completely out of character of a man you knew who always wore a smile wherever he was seen. I know I will be vilified by the LAPD and the media. And he goes on to say, unfortunately, this is a necessary evil that I do not enjoy, but must partake and complete for substantial change to occur within the LAPD and reclaim my name. Reclaim my name. Let's start there. Phil?
Well, I wanted to ask Dr. Lieberman about that because it sounds like the reclaiming my name is some sort of justification for going on this horrendous crime spree. I mean, here's a guy who grew up in law enforcement environment, you know, in the Navy, in the LAPD. He gets fired by the LAPD for allegedly lying about actions of a supervisor. And then he decides is the only way to reclaim his name is to start killing people? I mean, how do you go from 0 to 60 like that?
Well, it actually isn't 0 to 60. I mean, he spent years trying to reclaim his name. This was finally, like he says, as the subject, last resort. You know, he's reclaiming his name as who he sees himself as an upstanding officer and an upstanding Navy, former Navy serviceman. Now, and then he goes into terminating me for telling the truth of a Caucasian officer kicking a mentally ill man is disgusting. So the ultimate story of how he wasn't believed and this white woman was.
Racial injustice all the way through this thing, all the way through this manifesto. He's obsessed, right? He's obsessed with this issue of being mistreated. He's indignant about how people viewed him, right?
Actually, Chief Beck said that he was a man who collected grievances.
Chief Charlie Beck, new interview 2019.
He was a person that was what somebody might call a grievance collector, you know. Any failure or any slight was always due to the actions of others and not himself. And so his list of grievances were long and went very, very deep into the fabric of the LAPD.
And later on in his manifesto, he talks about an incident that happened when he was in Cypress High School, where an assistant principal, he's saying, talking to this assistant principal, and he says, "Remember when you lied to my mother and the police officer in your office about stating that you never stated to me in a private conversation that you know the theft suspect stole my watch? Let me refresh your memory. A physical education teacher's assistant, a student, stole the list of combination codes to people's lockers from the PE teacher. That student then opened many of these lockers and stole students' personal property. My watch was taken in that multi-theft, and I reported it to you. A week later, you discovered that the theft suspect was a student. You stated to me in private that you know for a fact that he stole my property. When I attempted to retrieve my property from the suspect, campus security was called, and you lied and stated that you have never stated to me that you know he stole my watch. You sat there and lied to their faces right in front of me. You said it was with such a deliberate, stern face. I never forgot that. I was not surprised when 13 years later I was lied on again."
And that's what you're talking, when you talk about the idea of reclaiming his name, that's where you're taking it back to.
Exactly. So these key incidents from his childhood were triggered, these memories and the rage were triggered by what happened to him in the police department when they didn't believe him over this woman who actually clearly did lie.
You know, it's interesting. Well, yeah, go ahead, Phil.
First of all, I don't know that it's clear that she lied. But second of all, there are a million people walking around who have suffered far worse indignities, Christopher Dorner, that don't turn into killing machines. So what I'm interested in getting your expert opinion on is why someone makes that transition. What turns someone into a killer? Is it possible to say?
Well, I think he was, first of all, seething for all of these years.
Right.
And then after this incident happened that I'm sure we're going to talk about in terms of the rights, you know, when they believed his superior officer over him and so on. And after that, for years, he kept trying to appeal.
Right.
And so it just kept building and building. Now, in between, before his rampage, he had been in the Navy and he had been in Bahrain. And we can talk about, you know, some potential diagnoses, but one could be PTSD.
Right.
And that could be a contributing factor. This manifesto, you know, some of it is very clever and some of it is disjointed. Of course, he was in a very emotional state when he wrote it. So
And it's long. It's like 15 pages. It's not like a couple of paragraphs. It's like very detailed.
And he also says this, which I think is kind of interesting. He's obsessed with the treatment he's had. Racial injustice is a big headline for him. But he says, "No one is saying you can't be prejudiced or a bigot. We are all human and hold prejudices. If you state that you don't have prejudices, you're lying. But when you act on it and victimize innocent citizens and fellow innocent officers, that is a concern." Which sounds completely opposite of the way he acted out.
Right. He's a complicated person just in terms of his psychoses. But I was struck by the fact, here he was so angry at the LAPD and ostensibly all law enforcement, right? But yet he was drawn to positions that were positions of power and control. He was in the military. He was a law enforcement officer. By what I heard from everybody was how charming he actually was. So if you met him one-on-one, you never got any sense of this powder keg ready to explode.
LAPD press conference, February 2013.
A particular interest at this point in the investigation is a multi-page manifesto in which the suspect has implicated himself in the slayings. Dorner's whereabouts are currently unknown to law enforcement, and we are asking for the public's help in finding him.
So here's where I would like to give it a little bit of a twist. And the twist for me came when actually reading this manifesto for the first time. I think we've all seen in the last 20 years, mass shooters who leave some sort of document or writing behind where they try and justify what happened, right? Chris Dorner goes into detail. Here's what led me to where I am today. I had no other choice. For me, the Chris Dorner story took a turn because of what he laid out in the manifesto after that. The way he laid out what he was going to do to the department and other people who got in his way as he exacted his revenge. I wonder if I can read you a little bit of this and get your comments on it. He says, "The violence of action will be high. I will bring unconventional and asymmetrical warfare to those in LAPD uniform, whether on or off duty. You will now live the life of the prey. Your homes away from work will be my battle space. I will use every tool that I learned. You have misjudged a sleeping giant. Mm. Whatever pre-planned responses you have established for a scenario like me, shelve it."
News reporters cover the murders.
He states in this manifesto he himself was denied the opportunity to start his own family, and so therefore he is going to make the families and the officers that he feels has wronged him suffer.
And he goes on to warn other departments. "This, my beef is with Los Angeles Police Department, but don't get in my way." And basically, right, if I'm stopped, you will not live to see a Medal of Honor for your actions. This is where I think it took a whole turn for the news business and people behind the scenes, and certainly I think for the city and the Los Angeles Police Department. Thoughts on that?
Well, one of the things that Chief Beck said, his feeling always was if he would shoot a police officer, he would shoot anybody. So they just considered him so incredibly dangerous, given his training, the huge arsenal of weapons that he had. All of this made him extremely dangerous. And the fact that he had proclaimed in writing that this was a grudge match and that he was willing to die in the commission of it. So think about all of those different facets pulled together, and you can imagine how very dangerous he was to anybody he encountered.
Chief Charlie Beck, new interview, 2019.
Time was of the essence. You know, there was no, you know, I could not get people there fast enough, in my opinion, because he was out, he was loose. He'd already proven that he would kill, and he said he was going to kill again.
It's surprising and fortunate that he, quote unquote, only killed four people.
Right.
Because if he wanted to, he could have killed, you know, indiscriminately.
The couple in the cabin, I think they were very lucky they escaped with their lives. Yeah. And I actually asked Chief Beck about that, and he said, well, in the end, probably if he had killed them, he would have drawn more attention than leaving them to survive.
And it seems from reading this, is this guy an intelligent person or a crazy person, which is a layman's term, obviously.
He could be both. But I just want to follow up what you were saying, Laura. You know, that is what, to me, the fact that he left the couple, he didn't kill them. He told them, I'm not going to hurt you. He tied them up, but... And then before that, he went to steal a boat, and there was a man with the boat, and he didn't kill him either. Mm-hmm. Now, I think in part that was to make his point that I really want to go after. It's the police department that made me do this. But also, I think it does show some humanity.
But he killed the two people in Irvine.
Well, and they were related. They were
the daughter of the police captain and her fiancé.
Well, yeah, right. Well, he said in his manifesto that the family,
part of the law enforcement,
the police
community.
And the family, right.
Yeah. Right.
Can we go back to Carol for a second here? Explain what you're saying, that he can be intelligent and he can be crazy
intelligent
at the
and
same
crazy.
Time.
Yes, there are lots of intelligent people who are crazy. You know, I was trying to, as I was doing research on this, I was trying to figure out his diagnosis, which, of course, without having, you know, examined him is a little difficult. But there are a few things to throw into the pot as differential diagnosis. First of all, in the manifesto, he talks himself about having a severe depression. And then one of his girlfriends, an ex-girlfriend, had said that he had extreme ups and downs, and that's why she stopped dating him and she put him on the Don't Date Him Girls website. So that would speak of either manic depressive illness, bipolar, or a lesser form of that, cyclothymic personality disorder. I mentioned before PTSD is a possibility because of his having been in Bahrain. And then, of course, underlying this whole thing, he could have as well a personality disorder. I mean, narcissistic, histrionic, paranoid, obsessive compulsive, sociopathic. He's, you know, he's kind of a potentially a mixture of a number of things. And it is sort of unfortunate that he didn't get into treatment earlier in his life. But, you know, his mother, I think there were problems, although I wasn't able to sort of dig them up. But I think there were problems in his relationship with his mother because and there were when he was in the cabin in Big Bear and he was having his last stand, you know, and it was the most tense moment. His mother was at a bar drinking wine, eating chips and salsa in a Mexican bar restaurant while she was watching him on television. Now, that kind of says it in a nutshell.
Wow. You think most parents would be huddled by the television, just gripped by what they were seeing.
And well, I mean, you know, she was probably gripped, but it just, that seems like a very inappropriate setting. Like, why wasn't she with somebody else? You know, maybe some other relatives or friends or something.
And, for support.
Yes, and drinking wine and salsa. I mean, it just, it seems like she was very into her own thing and not really why wasn't she maybe
it
in
sounds
a newsroom?
Like we're like making excuses for this guy because oh his mother didn't love him. I mean, come on.
Well, you know what?
Well,
I mean, I'm sure that's part of, you know, what turned him into what he became.
Yes,
but
yes.
isn't that overly simplistic?
Well, it's just part of it. But like, for example, when he was one way it can come into play, we know, for example, he was married once very briefly. And he didn't really have any other long-term girlfriends. So there was an issue with women. So I think that just compounded to all his problems.
Do we give him too much credence by
analyzing this?
And call, you know, the word manifesto we talked about, right? The Unabomber, that was the manifesto.
Manifesto implies some level of importance, right?
So are we giving
but
him
at the
too
end of the
credit?
Day, he was a cold-blooded killer. And when you think about the people he killed, he ambushed them. They never saw it coming. This poor couple sitting in a car like all of us do after we get back from somewhere, sitting there. He had been stalking them. He killed this young couple who were months away from getting married. They had everything to live for.
And to be clear about that, that was the first murder that we knew of, and that was on the top floor of a parking structure in a closed building. He had to get into that building, get up to that place, know where the car was, and that's why the stalking, to figure out what his plan would be. I think he probably was very analytical about all this stuff.
Yeah, he was skilled at what he was doing, but that's because of all of his training.
Late Sunday night, police found the bodies of 28-year-old Monica Kwan, a coach at Cal State Fullerton, and her fiancé, 27-year-old Keith Lawrence, a USC public safety officer. They were slumped in a car atop a parking structure where they lived in Irvine.
But the other thing that about the manifesto is that, you know, it's incredibly detailed, incredibly long. And because of his actions, everybody discounted what he had to say. I mean, we've all done many reports on this over the years. Mm. The way the LAPD handles internal discipline has always been very controversial. And his basic point was that he was discriminated against, that other officers, minorities, and officers of color, gay and lesbian officers to discriminate against. And it was the good old boys network that when you went to a Board of Rights hearing, they tended to believe who they were friends on the department with and that he was not treated fairly. And there's a lot of validity to what he said. I interviewed several cops after this thing happened who had similar stories. Now, they didn't turn into psycho killers, but it doesn't invalidate his criticism of the department. And I'd be interested to hear what Chief Beck said about that.
Well, and also that the representation is from someone within the department. I mean, think about it. If you're accused of a crime, we all want representation that doesn't have any, you know, somebody who's unbiased. That would be our hope, right? So that was one of his big gripes. Now, the department, since those times, of course, there's been this huge push toward community-based policing and letting the sun shine into the department. I think that a lot has changed since 2013. Some may take issue with that. But an effort to try to bring the community in, to be involved in the dialogue, and also for officers to have a means to be able to express their concerns without fear of repercussion. So I do think that something positive came out of this horrific 10 days. Is there room for improvement? Of course. There probably is within every single department or company that employs a lot of people, and the LAPD is huge.
Chief Charlie Beck, February 2013.
I don't for a minute discount the effect that Dorner's manifesto has had on the reputation of the Los Angeles Police Department. It needs to be addressed. You know, we are only as good as the public thinks we are.
Pete? Okay, so let me ask you about one more thing here. The guy is a very complicated guy. In the middle of all these documents, in the middle of talking about how he wants to exact his revenge against the Los Angeles Police Department, he also talks about broader issues in society, one of them being gun rights, gun control, and says, quoting from the document here, who needs an AR-15? No one. No more Virginia Tech, Columbine, Aurora Theater, Portland Mall, Newtown, Sandy Hook. Whether by executive order or through a bipartisan Congress, an assault weapons ban needs to be reinstituted, period. This is the same person that wanted to kill police officers. How do you reconcile those two characters?
Well, it is confusing. And I just want to say first, though, I am not, although, yes, I do have some compassion for this man, especially his ending, the ending that he came to. But I, of course, do not agree with or in any way endorse the people he killed and so on. So I just want to be clear about that.
I think we can stipulate to that.
Yes, okay. So yes, the difference between, you know, his using guns, he had a lot of guns, and then saying that people shouldn't have, well, of course, he was saying in particular people shouldn't have assault weapons and, you know, more dangerous kinds of weapons. But perhaps, you know, that was some way of thinking that if I didn't have access to all of these powerful weapons, I wouldn't be able to go on this rampage, or other people shouldn't be able to go on rampages like this.
And in the manifesto, he talks about his armament. He talks about this cache of weapons he has. He says, in my cache, you'll find several small arms. In the cache, Bushmaster firearms, Remington precision rifles, and AAC, suppressors, silencers. All of these small arms are manufactured by Cerberus Freedom Group, the same company responsible for the Portland Mall shooting, Webster, New York, and Sandy Hook massacre. And he brings that up because he says earlier that he quotes Mia Farrow, of all people. He quotes her and says, gun control is no longer debatable. It's not a conversation. It's a moral mandate.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this manifesto is fascinating in some ways. I mean, he goes in, he's very progressive on gay rights, on gun control. Mm-hmm. He talks about all these political figures, Colin Powell, General Petraeus. He talks about celebrities. Remember, he talks about Ellen DeGeneres, John and Ken, Bill Handel. I mean, it's, to me, looking back, it's almost like a shame that he wasn't able to turn whatever anger he had or injustice he felt into something positive, instead of leaving this behind, which everybody now ignores because he turned into a killer.
And that's the problem. I mean, he may have thought he was going to somehow be memorialized for doing whatever he thought he was doing, but he, whether he was right or wrong in his feeling of injustice, you don't go out and kill people, and so he completely destroyed whatever hope he had of having some kind of a reputation to follow, right?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing that has, besides the image of his being in the cabin, the thing that has impressed me the most about this whole story and him and so on is I watched the video of the man, Christopher Geller, the man who he, Christopher Dorner, and his superior officer, Teresa Evans, were called. I mean, this is the key, the crux of this whole rampage. They were called to a hotel where there was a man who was walking around, pacing and talking to himself, and he was reportedly schizophrenic and he had dementia. His name was Christopher Geller. And he and the whole thing was about whether his female superior had kicked Christopher Geller in the face, in the face once, or kicked him three times, kicked him, and in other words, use of force,
excessive force.
Yes.
Radio host Larry Elder, February 2013.
The Board of Rights, the burden of proof is not like a criminal trial. The burden of proof is it more likely than not that he filed a false report? So it comes down to the credibility of Sergeant Evans, his training officer, and him. Now, this guy has had a history of being disgruntled. Every slight in his manifesto you saw, he stacked up from the first grade on.
And so they had a Board of Rights hearing and so on. And also this Christopher Gettler had a father who Christopher Gettler told about what had happened. And Christopher Gettler, in this video, testifies to what happened. And he says it. It's he may be schizophrenic or have dementia. I don't know. But it was pretty clear in this video that he was saying that a female officer kicked him and he pointed to his left cheek, which is what Christopher Dorner had said. Now, the problem is that Christopher Dorner didn't include that in his original report about this incident because Teresa Evans asked him not to. And then in between when he did report it, you know, 2 weeks later, she had told him, warned him that she was going to give him an unsatisfactory review if he didn't improve. So, of course, they were saying that he just made this up in order to, you know, saying something bad about him, that she used excessive force because she had threatened to write him up as being unsatisfactory. Now, that may, you know, the only problem is that Christopher Gettler is very believable, as was his father.
Believable, maybe, but the actions that followed don't justify in any which way, shape, or form.
I'm not saying that killing, that justified killing even one person, but you can understand how the rage at the at the injustice, at the lies could build when here it is. Like, what else, you know, he was saying, what else do you need? Even the
man. So then why did the Board of Rights conclude that he was lying?
Well, he's saying, and it seems, you know,
believable.
Because
they wanted to get him?
Because they were protecting her.
She was better connected than he was.
Right. They were protecting her.
Which is the whole point of his manifesto.
Exactly. That he was mistreated.
Yeah.
He felt disenfranchised, and he felt that he didn't have a voice. It's when you look at the manifesto, it just expounds on that over and over again. And you can feel the hostility. And like you said, Phil, he also goes on to express some things, I think, in a rather, good
well-thought-out way.
Yes, yeah. He's thinking about how he feels
so
inside.
The Board of Rights, for people that don't know, it's two high-ranking LAPD officers and a civilian. And it's essentially like a hearing, right? And he was judged to be lying, and he was fired. He was dismissed from LAPD. He then appealed to Superior Court and then, I believe, to Appellate Court. Both times they upheld his firing. So he did have a voice in a sense that he was afforded all of the due process that the system has. He just didn't like the outcome.
Right.
Well, but the appeals, both of the appeals, they just basically deferred
to the original decision.
Right.
I understand. It's not a perfect system, but he did have due process.
But there was some sense that he had showed signs of anger issues early on, I think, even in the academy. There were some reports that, you know, he had no impulse control. So it wasn't like this was just one isolated instance.
Well, it's interesting that you bring this up. In 2006, when he was in the police academy, he complained about two recruits and saying that they made ethnic remarks against him. And one of these complaints was upheld. The other was not. And in any case, there's a feeling that he was shunned after that.
So, well, if I could point something out, because I'm the only person of color sitting here today. Any one of us who's a minority and came up during a certain period of time were called names, all right? I was called names early on. Even at my first job in television, I was referred to as the minority reporter. Hmm. It didn't shape me. It became my impetus to try to do something more with my career. I never let other people's labels of me define me. So he had that same opportunity. He could have taken his early experience and tried to do something positive with it instead of turn on an entire department and actually act out in the most egregious way than anybody could to take the life of another human being.
But as you say, it's about choices. It's making choices this way or that way. I just wanted to pick up one more thing in this manifesto. He felt that the cards were stacked against him in that Board of Rights hearing, that in the panel there was two captains and a city attorney. And the city attorney, he states, had a significant problem from the time the board was assembled, and that one of the captains was a personal friend of Teresa Evans when he was her supervisor at Harbor Division, and calls that a clear conflict of interest. And he says, I made my argument for his removal early on and was denied. He felt that he didn't have a voice among those who were judging him. And that might, I don't know, that might be true.
You know, this reminded me of one thing. I'm going a little bit out of order here on the manifesto, but in the middle of this 10 days, and you folks probably remember this, Chief Beck did something very, very unusual, and I was actually part of it, which was he called us in on a Saturday to the station I was working at across town. He wanted to get a message out to Chris Dorner. And so he called us in. You know, we talked with our bosses about what this might look like. Very unusual. The chief kind of requesting local airtime. Wanted to speak with our news anchor about it. And we decided that we didn't want to edit that message at all and be accused of any type of editing. What the chief wanted to say in this conversation with our news anchor, whatever that conversation was, that's what we were going to air. So we decided we would do a half an hour with the chief. And so he brought us down to downtown. That's where our anchor was, you know, police headquarters. And the chief wanted to get out the message to Chris Dorner that he was going to take another look at this whole case. That was in the middle of all of this, that he knew what the manifesto had said. And the crux of that conversation, aside from, you know, we hope you'll turn yourself in, was that basically message received, we're going to take a new look at this. And I think of it, they did take a new look at it. And eventually, I don't think the findings changed, that the firing was justified. That's what they found. But in the heat of all this, the one thing that Dorner did do, and Dorner would have known this, he was still alive at the time, this is in the middle of that 10 days, was that the LAPD said they were going to take a new look at this and what happened there. And we put that message on instead of our 5 o'clock news that night with our news anchor, with Charlie Beck, just a commercial-free half an hour discussing this case, discussing what the LAPD intended to do about it, which I thought, I've never seen that before. I've never seen it since. It was so unusual.
Yeah, I mean, its significance is of how things were, that how
the level of
crazy
fear.
Things were. Yeah. Yeah, fear and uncertainty, and people were afraid that anybody could be targeted. And so that was an example of the extreme measures that have never been done since.
But I think it is so important to focus on the victims in this case, these two young lives that were lost, an officer who was ambushed at a stoplight.
Chief Charlie Beck, new interview 2019.
You know, it's one thing to have these, you know, fleeting fantasies of revenge, but to kill innocent people that are helpless, you know, what kind of monster does that?
Absolutely, and I'm not in any way diminishing how important that is. But just to continue what you were saying, you know, I think, first of all, as they were getting closer to deciding that they were going to put an end to him once they knew where he was in Big Bear, you know, they're not going to find, they're not going to then, after he's dead, announce, oops, we made a mistake. Plus, even before he died and Chris Dorner knew that any reopening was unlikely to get them to change their mind, because at this Board of Rights hearing, it was so stacked against him with people who had conflicts of interest that he didn't really have any hope that a reinvestigation after all the appeals and everything else was going to change the results.
But he did bring a focus, and I think, Phil, you can speak to this, because Phil ran the Spirit, our station, where you just pored over this document, and you had a lot of people who were contacting you and our legal professional at that time, and they were telling you what?
Well, they were saying that what Dorner's basic gripe was of racial discrimination within the LAPD was a fact, and they had their own personal stories.
LAPD officer, February 2013.
I'm afraid that they will retaliate against me.
They will.
The department, internal affairs. I'm afraid of them. I've seen what they've done to other officers. I've seen them make allegations and ruin officers' lives.
And they felt that, like the doctor was saying, and like all of us are saying, is that it's a shame that he turned to violence, because obviously nobody endorses that and everybody abhors that. but it overshadowed the ability to shed some light in this organization. I mean, he goes back to Chief Daryl Gates days and before. And, you know, we're not LAPD members, but we've talked to enough to hear these kinds of stories. And obviously where there's smoke, there's fire. And sort of a footnote, and I've been unable to determine the resolution of this, but a couple of years later, Teresa Evans, his supervisor that was the start of it all, ended up suing the department herself, claiming that she, her career was derailed.
For racial discrimination.
Because she was a scapegoat, because she was part of the whole Dorner situation. So it just goes around and around. There's LAPD officers on the job right now, minority officers who have pending lawsuits against the department who are in the command staff. So the history of the LAPD is, you know, it's a world-famous organization which has done great things, but there's also a lot of controversy within the LAPD as well.
And when you think about, you know, what and nobody really know this, obviously, but if he had just turned that energy a different way,
right?
Something what he might have been able to do.
But in his manifesto somewhere, it says about how he didn't become a rapper. He isn't a wannabe rapper. He isn't in a gang. You know, he talks about all these different things that where he could have gone really bad before this. I mean, and instead he became a cop. He tried to do good things. He enlisted. He was in the Navy. You know, he did a lot of good things. So he.
Well, I think that's what I meant, Doctor, when I said earlier, I think he was drawn to a life of service. Mm-hmm. So it is truly tragic and ironic how he left the planet.
Mm-hmm. Honor, courage, and commitment. That's what's in his DNA, he said. And then he violated every principle that he claimed he lived by.
In the most extreme way.
Went on the killing spree. Mm-hmm. That's why it's so fascinating to me to have you here to shed some light on that, on how that happens.
What made him flip the switch, right. Exactly.
Yeah. So what triggers in the childhood then? What triggers later in teenagers? And what triggers later in adulthood?
Like to explain it a little better, these things in his childhood, when someone in childhood, traumas that happen to you are so much more important in terms of they leave so much, the scars are so devastating. It's like growing up with sort of a branch, you know, a branch of your tree sort of hanging loose or something, you know, so that when something happens later, you're just that much more vulnerable to flipping the switch.
So one more part of the manifesto I'd love to talk to you guys about before we move on to another topic is the last part of the manifesto. So now he's laid out, here are my gripes. Here's what I did great in life. Here are my gripes and why I'm bringing this carnage on everyone. Now let me go through a specific list of the people I'm angry at and the people who have inspired me in my life. Basically, and he lists all the officers that are kind of in his crosshairs and says, suppressing the truth will lead to deadly consequences for you and your family. There will be a surprise where you work, live, eat, or sleep. And then he quotes, you know, the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. But he also goes on to talk very flatteringly about other people, friends in his life that were there all along, celebrities and news anchors that he's looked out for. One of the news anchors I worked with says, I always thought you carried yourself professionally and personally. You are the epitome of a journalist anchor. You are America. As Phil said, he talks about Ellen DeGeneres. He talks about Tim Tebow. You're not a great football player, a QB player, but you are a great football player. They're actually talking about what a lot of the country thinks, right? Tim Tebow, not a great quarterback.
Yeah, a lot. There's like a couple of pages of this.
Yeah, it mentions a bunch of women.
Larry David, Kevin Hart, Lisa Lampanelli, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, Louis C.K., Dave Chappelle, Jon Stewart. It goes on and on.
And he talks to them on a personal level. It mentions a bunch of women, including Serena Williams, Kelly Clarkson, Nora Jones. You are the most beautiful women on the planet, period. Never settle, professionally or personally. Like, he's delivering a graduation speech. Like, they might hear these words and think, thank God Chris finally talked to me. I'm just curious, Doctor, what you make out of that and how he kind of ends it as a fond farewell.
Like a pep talk.
Yeah.
Well, it's his last words. You know, he knows these are going to be his last words, and he's thinking of everybody in his life, both his mentors. He talks about, as you said, a lot of his mentors who he wants to thank.
And then these various people, celebrities and so on. It's just, he wants the world to know what he, and he wants these people to know what he thought of them. It's interesting. He's pretty equal politically. He doesn't fall down. Bill Clinton is his favorite, but he also talks about Republicans. So he's not one way or the other. But Bill Cosby, you kind of wonder about when he wrote all of this. Did he write it all in one
fell
swoop? Was this a manic kind of tirade and, a writing spree that he was on? But, there is a lot of intelligent stuff along with his threats.
It's interesting because he goes from one thing to 180 degrees somewhere else. But there's a line in here that is interesting. It's almost like, if you do this, I'll stop doing that. So what he says is the attacks will stop when the department states the truth about my innocence publicly. And publicly is in capital letters with three exclamation points. And then he says, I will not accept any type of currency, goods in exchange for the attacks to stop, nor do I want it. I want my name back. And that's where we started here. I want my name back. Period. There is no negotiation, except he just kind of offered a leaf here. He just kind of tried to negotiate here and said, you stop this, I'll stop that.
Chief Charlie Beck, February 2013.
He says the killings are going to continue until you publicly come out and clear his name. Is that going to happen?
It is not going to happen.
Maybe if Chief Beck had said, we looked at it.
We were
and
wrong.
We were wrong. That probably, maybe, if he was watching television, would have stopped it rather than saying we're going to look at it again.
I remember us talking about that at the time and wondering whether, the chief had been coached a little bit in terms of it's almost like a hostage negotiation, right? Mm. So unusual, number one, for us to be called there on a Saturday. So unusual to be asked to share airtime uninterrupted. And so unusual, by the way, he, didn't address Chris Dorner, head on specifically, like, Chris, this is my message to you, but how he did say they would take another look at it. But you're right. I wonder what that conversation was behind the scenes. I wonder, and Laura, maybe you know from talking to the chief.
What he did tell me, Pete, was that it was a spontaneous decision to call that news conference. There was no gathering of people behind closed doors, what do I do next? He said in the moment, it felt like the right decision to call that news conference, and so I did, that he was going off gut instinct.
Yeah, it wasn't even a news conference. It was him and one camera, and,
I'm wondering if there was ever any thought to saying to him, I believe you, turn yourself in, we'll help you, even if maybe that wasn't 100% true or even close to being true, just as a negotiating tactic, like you mentioned, that hostage negotiation, just to try to save lives.
Well, I suppose it could
have maybe boxed him into might have boxed him into a future position he didn't want to be in. But I think they also thought, being who they are, they being the LAPD, that they were going to catch this guy pretty quickly. I don't think they would have envisioned 10 days, right?
What do you think, and Laura, maybe after talking to the chief, did he ever talk about what that was like when the department behind the scenes saw this document for the first time? I can only imagine that they must have had that same type of realization. But number one, we know this guy. Number two, this isn't good. This is not like a normal thing we've dealt with before.
Chief Charlie Beck, new interview 2019.
Becoming aware of the manifesto and the connection between somebody that I had some knowledge of on the LAPD, he worked for me at one time, came home to me as something that was going to just keep going and going and going, especially, when I read, how his hatred of the LAPD, his list of potential targets, and then, knowing his capability.
Well, it was like peeling back an onion. He talked about that initially they didn't realize that the death of Monica Kwan and her fiancé had anything to do with the department. And then when they started to piece everything together, and of course that big piece of the puzzle was the manifesto. So now they know that they are square in the target, right? That they are being hunted and pursued. So the first thing they had to do was to secure their loved ones, the targets.
And there were dozens of them, right?
Yes, yes, dozens of people. Chief Beck told me a very personal story that in his family, of course, he had a big old target on his back. He brought all of the members of his family under his roof. And they were all there.
Well, his son and daughter are officers, I believe.
Right, right. Yeah. He comes from a huge law enforcement family.
And his father.
His daughter, yeah. His son is now, I think at the time his son might have been in the academy, but his son is now an officer. His wife is retired sheriff's department. His father, I believe, rose to deputy chief. So this is a family where they're like a real-life blue bloods. I mean, this is what they've done with their lives. So they're all gathered under his roof, and the SWAT officers are living basically there in the garage to protect them because they were such a high-profile target. The only one who wouldn't come to the house was his dad. His dad said, I'm not going. You know, like a lot of dads would say, hey, I'm not going. But he also had a security detail with him yep. at his home. And they knew that Dorner knew where his dad lived. Mm. Because they would do the patrols, and his father lived in a particular section of town or of Southern California where Dorner had been part of the patrol. So mm-hmm. he knew where Beck's dad lived.
Wow. So here's where I'd like to hold on the conversation on the manifesto, and we're going to table that manifesto for another day. And the second part of this podcast, when we come back, we'll be talking about those days when police have identified that this is Chris Dorner, he is out to kill officers, he's on the run. What that fear was like for the department and for the public, what that hype and hysteria was like, the private behind-the-scenes tales of, you know, protection and special details and not knowing who's your friend and who's your enemy. We'd love to get into that next on the next part of this podcast.
Footnote to part one. The LAPD did look back into the Dorner case in that Board of Rights hearing. Former Police Chief Beck telling Fox 11, we reviewed the entire investigation and talked to the primary people involved, adding they found nothing irregular and the Board of Rights members were diligent and their findings were rational.